Hello, folks, and welcome to episode 64 of Try It, You Like It, the podcast where the three of us get together every couple of weeks and we choose a theme and we talk about a book and a movie around that theme. I'm Joseph Finn, and with me tonight are my wonderful co-hosts, Amy Watts.
Hello.
And Randy Perry.
Hi, everyone.
And how is everyone tonight?
Getting by.
Excellent. A little steamy here in Chicago, but I'll try not to collapse in a puddle of sweat or something. So before we get into this,
thunderstorming here, so I'll try not to dive under the couch.
That's always helpful. Or, you know, get disconnected.
Well, that too.
Yes. So before we get into the theme, we'd like to talk a little bit about what we've been enjoying lately. Randy, would you like to go first?
Sure. Just wanted to touch briefly on a couple of summer TV shows that I've been very much enjoying. I don't think I've talked about Brain Dead yet.
I don't believe so.
So, it's one of those things where, as I describe it, if you're not familiar with it, you will think I'm lying. You will think that I'm just making it up. It is Brain Dead. It's on CBS. It's from Robert and Michelle King, who co-created The Good Wife. And it's set in Washington, D.C., in a sort of quasi-real 2016, where Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are running for president, but the entire government seems to be somewhat fictional. And the government are being taken over by alien bugs who are eating people's brains and making them do weird and unusual things. And it's peculiar and funny, and no one is watching it, so it's not going to be renewed for a second season. But I am so glad that it's on for like 13 weeks this summer, and it, particularly as the normally chaotic U.S. election season has taken on extreme levels of chaos this year. Mary Elizabeth Winstead stars in it with Tony Shalhoub, Aaron Tveit, Megan Hilty, Beth Malone, a bunch of Broadway-type people, because it's from, you know, the Kings, and they like to cast New York people in who can sing, although they never make a musical episode. And it's just, if you were a fan of The Good Wife, particularly with their sort of sarcastic, not sarcastic, their sort of satirical tone episodes, like when they had the stuff with the NSA, that's kind of tone-wise where a lot of this show is going. And it's almost like the Kings, like, just came up with this weird idea and CBS gave them money and I can't believe it's actually on TV. But it's very fun, and there's probably, it's only going to be on for three more weeks, but totally glad it exists for this short period of time. The other thing I just wanted to briefly mention, I believe it's on Hulu in the US, is the comedy show Difficult People, starring Julie Klausner and Billy Eichner. And it's about horrible people sort of doing horrible things. It's one of those kind of shows. It's sort of in a way similar in spirit to It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. It's sort of similar to Always Sunny in Philadelphia, except instead of running a pub, Billy and Julie want to be famous, and they're comedy writers, and they want to be famous for their writing and performing. And it's in its second season now, and it's outrageously offensive. And this season has introduced Billy works at a little cafe, and I'm trying to remember the character's name. I can't think of her name, but they've introduced a waitress there who is a trans woman who is also a truther. So she's like 9/11 truther, Obama truther. Like, it's just, it's just, she's like one of the most outrageous characters I've ever seen on TV. And it's a lot of fun. I know Billy Eichner is not to everybody's taste, but he kind of tones down the yelling here, where he's just, here he's more rude and just says whatever's on his mind rather than yelling at people.
I know his name, but I honestly don't know if I know him. What would I have seen him in?
Parks and Recreation.
Yeah, he was Craig in the last couple seasons of Parks and Recreation, the loud gay
guy. I have to admit that I never finished watching Parks and Recreation because that way it never ended in my world. I think I'm joking, but I totally am telling you the truth. So keep going. Who else?
You would have seen internet clips of Billy on the Street?
No.
Like where he just goes around talking to random New Yorkers?
Oh, that's so not the kind of thing I would click on, so no.
But also in the cast, James Urbaniak plays Julie's boyfriend, Arthur, who works at PBS. And he's
now, that's
just
another one of those names I know, but I have no idea if I've actually seen him in things.
Yeah.
His best known role is, frankly, and he's not on screen. He's Dr. Venture.
Scream, the TV show. Yeah, I don't watch that.
And also, Andrea Martin is in it. And she is a hoot and a half, of course.
Now, I know her because she's on Star Trek. Sorry.
Anyway, yeah, I know I like to, I've gone to great lengths on this podcast in the past bitching about single cam sitcoms and how I'm sort of over them, and yet every couple of weeks I seem to find a new one that I enjoy, and Difficult People is another one of them. So
do we need to have a talk with you
about multicam sitcoms?
About how you can't really, how you're trying to constantly negate your actual desires.
Yeah, it's a problem.
Okay, Amy, so what do you got for us?
Well, I'm still, because there's always more, I'm still working my way through Star Trek. I'm in the midst, I'm still chugging away on both Deep Space Nine and Voyager. I watched the first three episodes of The Get Down. I just, like, hoovered them up in one giant marathon last Friday night. And it's kind of funny because I love it. And then all my favorite TV critics are kind of meh on it. And it's making me sad because I'm like, wait a minute, am I wrong for liking this as much as I do? Because normally, like, you know, there's certain things that I'll be quite contrary about that it's like people hate it, and I'm like, fuck you, I love it! You know, see, right, Jupiter Ascending. But then there's other things where it's like, you know, they love it, and I'm kind of like, eh, not interested, right? And so for them to just have such a profoundly mixed, you know, like, mildly positive, but not really that interested reaction to it, it's just like, breaking my heart, because what I love about it, and this is something I've been thinking a lot about just recently in relation to lots of different things, is I realized how much music is in my life. Like, I started thinking about how in any given day, I probably am listening to some kind of music or hearing some kind of music a good 12 hours of a day, maybe 8. I mean, because I usually have my headphones on at work and I'm listening to music. I listen to music in the car on the way to work. I listen to music in the car on the way from work. I listen to music in the morning when I'm getting ready. I mean, music is just so much a part of my everyday landscape. And, like, I'll hear people talk, like, you'll ask somebody, what's your, you know, like, it baffles me when I meet someone who says, about music, you know, I'll say, so what kind of music do you like? And they're like, I don't know. I guess I like all kinds of music, or maybe, I don't know. And I'm like, how can you not, like, have an answer for that? Or, you know, I'll say, what songs did your parents, like, when you were a kid, like, what songs did you guys listen to in the car on road trips? Or, you know, when you were cleaning the house, what did your, you know. And they're just like, oh, well, my parents didn't really have music on. We never really played music in the house. And I'm just like, that's like telling me, you know, oh, we didn't have running water. We just kind of, like, occasionally defrosted an ice cube and flung it around. I mean, I just don't even understand not having music in your life. And the thing I love about The Get Down is that the characters that they're focusing on, at least in the first three episodes, and the young characters, are like me in that they are so plugged into music. You know, like, it's just, it's around them, it's in them, and they're even taking it a step further and making it. And I think Baz Luhrmann, you know, who directed the first episode, which is 90 minutes long, so it's essentially a movie, you know, back before movies got so bloated. And he is just in love with that idea of music being just integral. And there's so much fantastic cinematography to me in that. I mean, you can definitely tell the first episode was directed by a film director, And it even was reminding me, because, you know, my favorite Lerman movie, and I may be a heretic for saying this, is still Strictly Ballroom.
That's because it's his best movie.
Thank you. Okay.
But, you know, after Moulin Rouge, of course.
No.
Randy and I are in sync on this. But I feel like...
Well, wrong, but in sync.
The Get Down is Lerman bringing the spirit of Strictly Ballroom with the budget of Moulin Rouge and Gatsby and his later works. And that's just a match for me. Like, there's a gorgeous scene in the first episode where he totally turns this girl who's living in a cramped apartment in the Bronx. I think she's Puerto Rican, maybe. Definitely some kind of Hispanic. And she's got this really tight-ass preacher father, and she snuck out to go to the disco, and she's wearing this fabulous gold lamé pleated halter dress. And she stops on the stairs, and, like, everything goes a little soft focus around the edges, and it becomes slow motion. And to the tune of Donna Summer's Bad Girls, she gets to have her Marilyn Monroe 7-year itch moment. And, I mean, I just basically wanted to run and hug my TV. I was so happy with that in that moment. So, I mean, I'm just so sad that it's not getting the kind of critical acclaim that I want it to. But we'll see. I thought it was interesting. The critics who came closest to my feeling about the show were Tom and Lorenzo, who do the Tom and Lorenzo blog that used to be Project Runway a million years ago. Because they pointed out in their review that they seem to be differing from most critics, as most critics aren't liking the pilot episode, the first episode, and are liking the later episodes more that were directed by other people. And they were like, no, we like the first episode. And, you know, and I'm like, yeah, because it wants that sort of crazy over the topness. I mean, that's what he's doing, is he's got this crazy world and he's capturing it. And I mean, it's got so many of the Lerman hallmarks in the sense of music and dancing and young people and star-crossed lovers and, you know, authority figures that you're trying to put down with dance or music in this case. I mean, it worked for me is all I can say. So I'm a big fan of The Get Down, and I haven't watched any more of it because I want to watch the next 3 episodes all in a row. One of the articles I read about The Get Down was talking about how it is kind of turning this, I've talked before about how I don't necessarily like the Netflix plan of dump all 13 episodes at once. You know, that sometimes I kind of like being able to, especially with shows that I want to talk about, only having an hour's worth of material to discuss each week. And then you wait for the next one, and then you have that conversation, and then you wait for the next one, and then you have that conversation. You know, instead of feeling compelled to have to watch, you know, nearly 13 hours of scripted television in one sitting. But the point this article made is that The Get Down is kind of a start and stop it whenever you want sort of venture. And they're not wrong. And one of the really clever things they do is that the beginning of each episode, you have it starts with a combination of a framing device previously on and the theme song. Those 3 things are all the same thing, which really does mean that you can start and stop it whenever you want, because it doesn't necessarily close at the end of an hour in the way that you expect it to. And so I like watching it all in a row, which is not something I necessarily like doing when they're episodes that are clearly meant to be distinct episodes. So this weekend, I'm going to finish it.
All righty. I have a few things to go through real quick. First off, Amy, I have started Party of One, the Dave Holmes book, and so far, quite excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Randy, I've been reading something Canadian.
I'm sorry.
Can you read Canadian?
I finally started reading some Robertson Davies, so I've been reading the Deptford trilogy. Classic Canadian, and so far liking it a lot. It's pretty much 19. I think the where I'm up to at the moment is just post World War II Canada. It's quite funny. I wasn't really expecting that. It's very bleak, but also very funny. Kind of hard to describe in terms of not the great American novel so much as it is a cynical great Canadian novel. How's that?
Sounds good.
Yep. A couple more things. I finally got around to seeing Grandma, which I think, Randy, you had seen?
Yes.
Yes. Amy, have you seen Grandma?
I guess not.
Okay. Lily Tomlin and Julia Garner from The Americans. It's excellent. Everybody should check this out. And I was really surprised at the end of it. I'm not that surprised because I was a huge fan of About a Boy, but I somehow had totally missed that it was directed by Paul Weitz.
Right.
And yeah. It's a really good little movie. Great cast. Lily Tomlin's fantastic. Julia Garner is somebody who I think we're all going to be keeping an eye on throughout the years. Then you have Sam Elliott with a level of bitterness that I didn't even know he had in him. It's like, wow, where did that come from? Really worth checking out. And finally, I got around to the paperback of Archie, the volume one, the new Riverdale. This is a Archie book that they put out starting last year, which is by Mark Waid, who usually writes for DC, writes a lot of Flash, Green Lantern, various other things. And the Archie people wanted to have a updated Archie that's still Archie. And I'm really impressed with how actually good it is. They're not trying to make it like, oh, let's do the teen talk. No, it's just a good Archie story that's just really done well. And I'm like, okay, this is actually pretty impressive. Most of it drawn by Fiona Staples, who's very well known these days for Saga. It's really worth checking out. It's good, it's charming, and the best character is Jughead because he's some kind of mad genius in this one, but it's still Jughead. It's some good stuff. I know, I'm recommending an Archie book. Give me a break.
That's probably the comic book I've read the most issues of, so whatever.
Hey, there you go.
But then I used to always buy it at the gas station on road trips.
And in this case, it's a continuous story. It's not the just one story per book deal, which is kind of nice. So let's get into the theme for this week. And just checking my notes here. Randy, you have the theme. Tell us about it.
I did. And while it was initially optimistic, or works about politics that could be considered optimistic, that was decidedly too difficult. So change that from optimistic to just kind of non-cynical, that they could be like realistic works about the real work that can actually be done in a good way in a political system.
Excellent. I had the novel, and I decided to go with a piece of nonfiction this time around. I wanted you guys to read 1776, subtitled in the UK is 1776, America and Britain at War, a David McCullough, book from 2005, which is about that very pivotal year in U.S. and, by extension, British history. And it basically covers, in a lot of ways, how the war shaped up in that first year, but it also gets into the politics of there was a lot of posturing back and forth between the Americans and the British. There were some not very good conciliatory gestures by the British, and how Washington was dealing with a army that was falling apart, as well as dealing with the Continental Congress back in Philadelphia. That's basically the bones of what it is. It's a bit more of a military book than a politics book, but I think it pretty much fit the theme. Since this was your theme, Randy, what did you think of it?
I am one of those people who, probably from now until the end of my life, anytime I read or see or in any way interact with anything set in this at this point in history, Hamilton is going to be going through my head. Various songs, various lyrics, various characters, and how they were presented in Lin-Manuel Miranda's musical relative to history. And so, of course, this being set in 1776, there's a lot of characters that appear, or there are a lot of people that appear in this book that were also characters in the musical, and not just like the big obvious ones like George Washington, but like Philip Schuyler and Charles Lee. Like, these names came up a few times in the book, and so I just kind of went to lyrics in my head whenever their names would appear. Oddly enough, it's the kind of thing now. Hamilton and Burr both make appearances in 1776. Although, and this is one of the advantages of an ebook, you can easily check how many times names appear. And I believe Hamilton himself, his name appears only 3 times in the book, and Burr's Aaron Burr's name appears once. Which, given where we are as a culture right now with the mind-blowing success of Hamilton itself, like, it's just David McCullough wrote this in a different time frame. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, any future histories that are written about 1776 or the American Revolution are just, they're going to be consciously or subconsciously filtered through what Lin-Manuel Miranda did. That's just a random point. Has nothing to do with the book itself. As for the book, I kind of liked it. I liked the story better than the book. It's in some ways it's somewhat arbitrary. Like, that David McCullough, the book basically, not exactly, but basically starts at the beginning of 1776 and ends at the end of 1776, which seems somewhat arbitrary, and just kind of like a gimmick for getting to write this book. But there's definitely a lot of compelling stuff in it. My issue is that, I don't know, have either of you read the Iliad?
Yes.
No.
Don't worry, I'm not going to make you read the Iliad, but there's a long sequence in the Iliad that is basically just a list of all the ships and all the people and all the men who are fighting, and it's interminable. And parts of this book felt like a cataloging of who was involved in a particular incident rather than actually telling the story of the incident. It's an incredible job of research and compiling so many sources of information, but I got really bored reading it at certain parts of it. And I think part of that sort of works against it as a narrative, because at other points throughout the book, McCullough he'll introduce, like, you know, John Smith's journal from the time included this, and that's the only time you ever hear from him. So it doesn't really contextualize all of these people. It's just sort of like, you know, he saw George Washington drive by on a horse once, and so we've got to mention him in the in the book. But I mean, obviously there are, and you guys know this better than I do, since I'm sure the American Revolution is a much more innate subject from your school learnings than it would have been from mine. There are a lot of stories that are worthy of being told here, and I liked the stories and some of the writing, but just as often I did find myself skimming and sort of flipping pages a bit quickly.
Alrighty. Amy, what'd you think?
Well, so I'm really mad at myself because I could not find my actual copy of the book that has all my hastily scribbled notes stuck in it, on pieces of paper, because it's a library book. I didn't write in the actual book. Calm down. All right. But one of the things that struck me was, okay, so this book came out, you said, in 2005, right?
Yeah.
So a decade ago. And I guess I am too white and too old to probably really use this term accurately, but I feel like maybe in the last, let's say, 3 to 5 years, and a lot of it I credit to social media and the internet at large, I have become more woke. Okay, let's just all cringe for a moment. All right. But let's just say that I have become more aware of how we present things and the context and stuff like that. And I think I was tweeting out a little bit as I was reading this book and noticing some things and, you know, going online to look up things and stuff like that. And there is a part of me now that can't help but read something like this and want to insert some things in there. You know, like, oh, well, you mentioned his wife, but just in passing, now I, you know, you're like, well, he left Philadelphia and had left the wife and kid there because he was so enamored of Washington. And there's this part of me that's like, well, I want to hear that story. But, you know, oh, no, wait, this is a history book, so we talk about the men. You know, I mean, which, fair enough, like you say, you know, Randy, one of your criticisms, which I think is a valid one, is like, okay, this guy rode by on a horse, let's put him in. You know, the book would have been even longer if we dealt with all the women. But there's a tiny part of me in the back of my head that just can't help but read a book like this in that way now. But I will credit McCullough because I was starting to kind of keep score, and he did make a good and deliberate point at one point of talking about Washington's Mount Vernon and basically flat out stating that Washington could not have had such an estate running the way it did without slave labor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I did appreciate McCullough getting that in, you know, and honestly, a book written in 1995 might not have felt the need to acknowledge that as clearly, you know? So we have come a long way in how we're writing about history, but I don't know that we're fully there yet. So that was kind of one of my main criticisms with it. So that was kind of one minor criticism of it. Otherwise, I mean, I think I'm kind of in the same boat of Randy of skimming a lot of it. Just because I am such a slave to narrative. And, you know, yes, this does have a narrative, but like you say, there's so much exposition. Like, if this was a novel, you would cross out about 75% of it and say, get to the story!
Yeah.
You know, which I realize it's not a novel. It's not supposed to do that. I understand. I'm judging it unfairly. I'm just saying that that's where I didn't exactly relate to it. Okay. Also, I kept wondering, because of the title, when do they start singing?
Ugh.
When does John Cullum sing? And he never did, and that made me sad.
Put a pin in the name John Cullum. I've got a point to make later involving that name when we're talking
from
about the movie.
From my hometown of Knoxville, Tennessee.
I had a question. What did you guys think? One of the things I admire about this book is that it also gets into, to an extent, the British side of things, which I think a lot of histories of the American Revolution neglect. It's all, oh, there's Washington and there's Jefferson and whatnot. But I don't think a lot of the histories get enough into what the British Parliament was up to, what the mood was over in London, that sort of thing. Did you find it interesting?
I did like that part. Because like you say, I mean, you know, to kind of piggyback off something Randy was saying earlier, which is that, okay, yeah, this is something that, you know, if you grow up in America, you hear about the revolution in history class and, you know, you're taught it a certain way. And, you know, we're generally taught greedy king, no representation, revolt, you know. And to kind of hear that, okay, no, wait, I mean, you know, yeah, that's a gross oversimplification of it. But to kind of hear some of the machinations that went into it, I did find that interesting to sort of hear about it from the other side. Can I say something, though, that's going to reveal exactly what a non-history major I was?
Sure.
So having read this book, there's a part of me that wondered, how did Canada end up where it is? I don't mean geographically. I mean,
yeah, she got ahead of the joke.
Millions of years ago, the tectonic plates. No, I don't mean that. But, like, why was Canada... Why did Canada never have a revolution? And so now I feel like I almost want to go seek out a book that explains to me, like, Canadian-British politics and, you know, why you guys stayed with the mothership and we didn't.
Yeah, and I have taken far too few history classes, even, and this would have been 25 to 30 years ago anyway, to speak really intelligently about it. But Canada...
In some ways, it's explaining an absence, if you see what I mean, in the way that I'm asking the question.
Yeah, and the part of it was Canada never broke from Britain.
Right.
Like you guys did. Because... That is a good question. We did, like, in the 60s, as in, by which I mean the 1860s, when, you know, the Confederation of Canada, it was, like, basically about self-government and stuff like that. But it was never about being free of England. It was about still being part of the Commonwealth and just governing yourself.
Well, because this actually caused me to go look up, okay, so how does Canada work? how does Canada work with a lot of bacon grease and a little bit of maple syrup? No. Because I was fascinated to find out about the whole, like, essentially the Queen's, what do you call it? Like
the governor general?
The governor general?
Yeah, and like that advisory, like, because you don't have a House of Lords because you don't have lords.
We have a Senate.
But you do have a House of Commons.
Yes.
But not a House of Lords. And so you have this other thing that kind of sort of fits in that slot, kind of. And I don't know, it was just fascinating to me, and I realized how little I know about Canada.
Yeah, and at this point, I mean, the role of the Governor General and the relationship with England and with the Queen is essentially purely ceremonial and decorative. It doesn't really impact our...
That's what you think, but you never know now with this whole Brexit thing. They may say, all right.
Tis true.
I don't know. I always kind of love that you could make the case that Canada technically became independent in 1982.
Yeah, that's the other thing as well. Like from 1863 to 1982, we were the Dominion of Canada.
What happened in 1982?
I don't remember. I was like 8.
It's called...
what's different about what was going on in 83 that wasn't in 81?
There was an Act of Parliament that I think it was just called the Canada Act that the UK Parliament that basically devolved the relationship, so now Canada was independent. That's my remembrance of it.
That seems like my vague understanding of it too. So yeah,
I think the big thing was that they didn't have to deal with the British Parliament in terms of passing laws. So now the Canadian Parliaments were. I'm sorry.
Had they before then, like in 1980, was Canada writing over, "Dear England, we would like to make this bill law."
Yes.
Really.
I don't think
in
it was
the year
ever...
of our Lord, 1980, they're having to get approval from the home country.
I don't think it was everything, but I'm pretty sure there were certain types of laws that they had to appeal to the British Parliament for. I know, right?
Huh. Fascinating. Sorry, so I just got... I mean...
Did we just blow your mind?
It kind of did, but it's like... But I don't know if that's a criticism or not of the book that I'm reading this book about American history, and it makes me want to read a book about Canadian history.
Yeah, there you go.
So make of that what you will.
I honestly was thinking while I was rereading it, I'm like, you know what? I want to read a little bit more about the abortive attempts to invade Canada during the U.S. Revolution.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, like, for us... In my junior high history classes, it was more about the War of 1812 rather than what had happened, like, during your war.
Yeah, I think it was very small attempts that never really went anywhere.
And here's exactly what I remember about the War of 1812. The White House burned. That's it. That's all I remember. Yep. There, and then there's something, and I don't know if it's actually connected with 1812, or if it was a whole did the War of 1812 carry on past that year?
1812 to 1814.
Yeah.
Right, because in 1814, along the mighty Mississippi.
Along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi.
Mighty Mississippi. That is exactly everything I know about the 1812, is that fire cannonballs out of an alligator and the White House burned.
I
was on Jeopardy!
This is no joke. I actually admire the burning of the White House, because the Brits went in, they had exactly, I forget, they had, I think, 5 targets in Washington that they went in, they took care of them, and they got the hell out. It was a great raid. They went in, burned exactly what they were supposed to, did nothing else, no burning of civilian property or anything like that, and got the hell out of there.
And they didn't even stop for like a panty raid anywhere. Sorry, I'm feeling silly tonight. Okay.
It was purely psychological.
Panty
raid! But then we kicked their ass in the rest of it, like Lake Erie.
All right. Yeah. Well, wait. And then Dolly Madison hightailed it with some art out of the White House.
Declaration of Independence and a painting of George Washington.
And don't even tell me that's apocryphal and has since been proved wrong, because I love Dolly Madison and I want to keep believing that story.
I'm honestly not sure. I'm pretty sure it's considered pretty true.
I want to believe.
Incidentally, played in Drunk History by Casey Wilson. I always remember this.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a pretty great episode. And speaking of Hamilton, we haven't even noted the whole Lin-Manuel Miranda is going to be on Drunk History, which is awesome.
With apparently Aaliyah Shawkat and Aubrey Plaza.
Yep.
Yes.
And if you can go on YouTube, by the way, and you can see the very first episode of Drunk History when it was still YouTube, is I forget who was narrating that one, but they did Hamilton on that very first episode. And this is before they had gotten it quite right as to the level of drunkenness. He is passing out about halfway through.
Whoops.
But it was already pretty good looking. They already had costumes going. It was already the narrating and the people talking over the narration type deal. It was well done. Michael Cera playing Hamilton in that version.
Wow.
And Jake Johnson playing Aaron Burr. Huh. It's like 2011, I think. So we've got way off track, and I think that's a symptom of how, okay, maybe this book wasn't the greatest choice in the world. I'll do better next time.
No, it was a good book. I'm just a bad audience for it.
That's fair. Let's move on to the movie, because I got some things to talk about with this movie. So,
okay.
Amy.
So I picked the recent HBO film All the Way, which is let's just say it's the LBJ movie. And we'll talk a little bit more about exactly what we mean by that when we get into the discussion of it. It was first a play on Broadway, which Randy and I both had the opportunity to see, albeit separately. Randy had much better seats than I did and got to sit next to famous people and meet famous people, because Randy lives that kind of life. But we both enjoyed it, I think, as a play.
Yes.
I think you might have liked it a little better than I did, maybe.
I think I did, yeah, if I remember correctly.
I liked the performance of Bryan Cranston was probably the best thing to me about the play, and he reprises. How do you say that word?
Oh,
I would say it than I, yeah.
Reprise.
I don't know, let's ask Charlene.
Fuck off. reprises his role as Lyndon Baines Johnson, for which he won the Tony. So I guess, I think it's in this Emmy period. Did he get nominated for it?
Yes, he did.
So I guess he's probably, if he's not a lock, he's probably a very good bet to win the Emmy for it as well. When I say let's hold off talking about exactly what it's about, So in terms of what this movie is about, it leads directly into one of my criticisms of both the play and the film, which is that it's called All the Way, which was, of course, one of LBJ's slogans for election in 1964. The story starts with LBJ assuming the office in the wake of Kennedy's assassination, and then is in the lead up to the election, which would be, you know, roughly a year later. A big part of it is relating to the Civil Rights Act, and then what would later become the Voting Rights Act as a separate act. So that brings into the picture Senator Richard B. Russell and also black political leaders of the time, including Martin Luther King Jr. So my criticism of the play and then of that, which carried through to the movie, is I never felt like it quite figured out what it wanted to be about. Was it about the Civil Rights Act? Was it about, you know, getting elected? You know, which was it more about? Because my problem with the play was that, and there was some of this in the film as well, I felt like we spent too much time away from LBJ in scenes exclusively with the black leadership, which I understood in some ways from the point of view of it being a play, because, you know, Bryan Cranston needs to rest every now and then. He can't be, he doesn't necessarily want to be on stage for every damn scene. But within the context of the film, it's like, well, okay, now you don't have that excuse anymore, but now you are trying to faithfully replicate what people got to see on Broadway, blah, blah, blah. So that was kind of I'll open that up for discussion with you guys later, but that's kind of a summary of what it is it's covering roughly a year from the assassination of JFK to the election of Lyndon Baines Johnson in November 1964. I have several talking points, but I guess in general, I just want to get your reactions. First, let's talk to Joe first, because you had not seen it as a play, so you were coming to it with fresh eyes and able to judge it only as a film, as the film it is. So what did you think?
What I think is it's very strong, but you have brought up what I was already going to talk about, is what is the viewpoint of this? It's so strong with the LBJ stuff. And then you have Anthony Mackie can be a very talented guy, but I think he's out of his depth as Martin Luther King Jr. I just think he is. And I felt every time we were in those scenes, I'm like, maybe we should go back to the LBJ stuff or recast Martin Luther King. And I felt bad about that because I'm like, this is necessary stuff. This is good stuff that should be in here. But I wanted it done a little bit better.
Well, I can tell you, the guy that played MLK on stage was great.
You know who that was, Amy?
Who?
Brandon J. Durden, who now plays Stan's partner, Aderholtz, on The Americans.
Really?
Yep.
I did not make that connection.
Okay. Why do I know that name? I'm looking him up now. His big credit. I am so far behind. I haven't seen most of the most recent season. Besides that, a lot of TV that I haven't watched, like The Good Wife and Big C. Okay, anyway.
Well, what I'll say is that the guy who played MLK, I mean, he was great. I would say he was better than Mackie. Because for me, my problem with Mackie in this casting is that I know what Anthony Mackie looks like, and he doesn't look like Martin Luther King. And I just never stopped seeing Anthony Mackie and started seeing Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Like, no matter how good the performance was, I just kept seeing Anthony Mackie. And, you know, again, I don't necessarily mean let's cover him in prosthetics, but more that, you know, it's like I feel bad for some actors because once you hit a certain level of movie star famous, it's hard to play a historical figure. Like, I can believe that, I can believe that Tom Cruise is Ethan whatever from Mission Impossible, because that's a fictional person. Why wouldn't that fictional person look like Tom Cruise? Sure, why not, right? But I couldn't buy Tom Cruise as a real person if he still looked like Tom Cruise.
Right.
I just need to cut that sentence off right at, I couldn't buy Tom Cruise as a real person.
But you know what I mean. Yeah, you know what I mean. Yeah. Like, you hit a certain level where you hit a certain level of, I guess, face recognizability.
Well, there's that, and from the other perspective, there's also the level of fame of just recognizability of the person they're playing, and you know, all the video archival footage that we've all seen of Martin Luther King speaking, like, he's just such a vibrant force as a public speaker that it's almost impossible to for an actor to kind of capture that.
And also, like,
just, we think just, that, oh, go ahead.
Go, no, you go ahead.
I was going to say, and that's kind of, you know, with a bunch of like the big personalities, like, I was just trying to think of other similar examples where I thought an actor might have captured like a big personality like that. And the best example I could think of was Judy Davis as Judy Garland in Me and My Shadows. Like, and of course, the gay man goes to the Judy Garland movie. But...
Well, I mean, I think another big personality is Nixon, right? And we've had two very lauded portrayals of him in the Anthony Hopkins and Frank Langella. And, you know, I never believed either one of those guys was Nixon.
Oh, that's right. You know, I forgot about Frost Nixon. Sorry.
Yeah. It's like, I thought, okay, you know, that's Anthony Hopkins playing Nixon. That's Frank Langella playing Nixon. And they're doing a very good job of playing Nixon, but they're not Nixon.
Right, which
like,
is...
honestly, the person to play Nixon that reminded me, that felt the most like Nixon, was Dan Hedaya in Dick.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
Honestly. Like, he evoked the most, oh yeah, sure, you know, like, if I kind of just glanced, I could think that was actually Nixon.
Second place is Philip Baker Hall in the Robert Altman
Secret Honor,
yes. Because he's not trying to play Nixon, he's trying to play a weird, drunken version of Nixon. He's not trying to play the public Nixon.
But, I mean, you know, Bryan Cranston clearly had use of prosthetics and, you know, hairstyling and wigs and or whatever, you know, whatever he did to really transform himself physically into LBJ. But I also think that, you know, if you've watched Malcolm in the Middle and you've watched Breaking Bad, you already know that Cranston is a bit of a chameleon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so him, he, even though he's a famous actor, his face isn't famous, because his face has been famous in two very different incarnations.
And he's famous for being an actor, not for being a star.
Right. Like, I mean, I think Anthony Mackie is a fine actor. But I will also say, to me, Anthony Mackie is cool. And Martin Luther King Jr. was many things, but not cool.
Not in that way, at least.
Like, he was more earthy somehow, you know? Like, I don't know how to describe it except to say that, like if you talk about the way that Fred Astaire dances and the way Gene Kelly dances, you're not saying either one of them was a better dancer, or but you're saying they moved different, they felt different, they came across differently. And you know, it's that same kind of thing. I can't put my finger on it, but the charisma that Mackie has is different than the charisma that Martin Luther King Jr. has. And I will tie this all back into your point, Joe, by saying that the stage actor for Martin Luther King Jr. was really fantastic as Martin Luther King Jr., and yet I still felt like the scenes needed to be edited or cut out in the theater version. So that was my impression of the MLK stuff.
I have a couple points to build on here. I think what really helps with Cranston, besides this, and it's a great performance, let me just get that out of the way, whoever did the prosthetics for it, the ears, it really helps. Those ears are fantastic. I was looking at them going, how much of that is real? Because they look great. Just the perfect size. They're really well done. But I want to talk about some of the other actors in this movie in terms of what you were talking about, in terms of famous people, that you have some very good character actors in this, in parts where nobody remembers what the hell Hubert Humphrey looks like.
Who's not our age. Yeah.
And Bradley Whitford just has basically a receding hairline. People vaguely remember what Hoover looks like. Root is kind of that. Nobody, I defy anyone who didn't go to UGA to say what Richard Russell looked like.
Although, I need to bring this up. My biggest problem with this televised film of All the Way is the casting of Frank Langella. And I have a list. May I give you a list of why I do not like Frank Langella as Richard B. Russell?
Sure.
And let me say this. I work at the University of Georgia. We have so much shit named after him on our campus. It's unbelievable. But I am not from here. I am not personally invested in him in any way as part of my history or heritage or anything like that. So get that. That is not the case. But here are my problems with casting Langella as Russell. Number one, he's so Italian looking. Like, to me, Frank Langella does not look like the Scotch-Irish guys that are all over the place down here.
Fair.
He does not look like that. Secondly, he's played the bad guy in movies too often and too memorably. Most memorably, as it relates to this film, in Dave. Like, I could not, in this movie, deal with him as the antagonist without thinking of him as, what was he? What was his role in Dave? Like, the role in the White House?
He was Bob, the White House Chief of Staff.
Chief of Staff, that's right. I was going to say, he wasn't like Senate leader or something. He was the Chief of Staff. And, you know, I think of him and, like, I just kept thinking of him, you know, and obviously in that, it's his villainy is comedic because it's a comedic film. But I just could not, and I feel like there's enough of an overlap between the audience that has seen Dave and the audience that is watching this movie, you know, that it's hard not to just, you know, you see Frank Langella in the White House and you're thinking Chief of Staff from Dave. His southern accent came and went, and when it was there, wasn't entirely believable to me. I just did not like him at all. I mean, I'm not saying his acting was bad, but I just felt like he was woefully miscast as Richard Russell. And I'm also a little bit biased because John McMartin, the late John McMartin, played him on stage and was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And so I will kind of throw this guy out to you guys. Fantasy recasting. Who would you like to have seen as Russell?
I have no opinion because I don't know enough about the real American history at this point
you
in time.
You don't know enough about Russell, but it's just like, you know, in the role of Southern politician, staunch segregationist, who would you pull in?
Let's see. You need somebody in their 60s.
I'm going to tell you who mine is, and you can tell me what you think of it.
Nope, I think I got one. Except he's a...
I just said one.
Oh, but sorry, I missed it because I was talking.
You said John Slattery.
Huh.
It's very...
I can tell you, looking at pictures, he does not look anything like Russell.
It's very Boston.
Well, yeah, but yeah.
See, I have one. Stephen Tobolowsky.
No, too Polish.
Too Polish. He's a Texan.
Tobolowsky?
Yeah, he's from Dallas.
Yeah, but he looks like an accountant.
So did Russell.
Anyway, no, I did not like Frank Langella as Russell, and it really just like, I would have to knock a whole letter grade off the movie just for that casting.
Whereas I think he elevates it. I think it's a fantastic performance about a really interesting guy in U.S. history, who, even though he was a staunch segregationist, pardon me for putting it this way, he wasn't one of the turn-the-fire-hose-on segregationists. He was a little more nuanced than that.
Yeah, although in some ways that makes him more evil.
Yes. I'm not saying he was a good man.
The kind of refrain going on now surrounding this election is, okay, but what about the next guy who has all the same opinions and aims as Trump, but manages to do it without sticking his foot in his mouth every other day?
Yeah. Just remembered to do just something I wanted to remind myself about. When you mentioned John Cullum before, I spent about half an hour thinking the guy who played Judge Smith was John Cullum until I finally realized it was Ken Jenkins, who was Dr. Kelso on Scrubs.
Yeah, yeah.
Whoops. Wrong guy.
Again, talking about casting. So in the Broadway version, J. Edgar Hoover was played by, help me, Randy, McKeon?
Was it Michael McKeon?
Yes, Michael McKeon. And here, played by Stephen Root. And so I just kind of wanted to ask you guys, what is that that in both the play and in the theatrical and film version of this, they went for as Hoover, an actor primarily known for comedic roles? I mean, not to say that McKeon and Root have never done dramatic roles and that they're not capable of it. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that we know both of those actors far more for their comedic roles.
I think part of it is that, quite frankly, even at the time, dangerous as he was, Hoover was farcical in just his weird obsessions. I mean, he was almost the epitome of the let's go after the communists and forget the things about warrants. And I think getting a actor who can kind of put that little bit of a farcical spin on it works.
Can I have to say, when I saw it in the theater, I almost squirmed a little bit during some of the Hoover scenes. Because I felt like it turned into a little bit of, let's make fun of the crossdresser.
Well, especially in the scene with him and LBJ, where they're talking about the guy who got caught having gay sex.
Yes, the
Walter,
who was a personal aide to LBJ and wife.
Yeah, and like the subtext of that, you know, scene, just how they were talking about something else, but they were both kind of clearly also talking about Hoover himself.
Right. And it felt like to me sometimes it skirted the line of, it's one thing to make fun of Hoover's hypocrisy, mm-hmm. but it's a different thing to make fun of Hoover's own predilections.
Which I don't think this did.
I just felt like with McKeon, they were right on that line
mm-hmm.
with that performance of, you know, kind of almost to the point of limp wrist and lisping in some places, you know. I thought, to me, that's an interesting choice to make Hoover the comedic relief. A couple of other things. I wish they hadn't started with the bloody car.
Yeah, I was looking. Yeah. I'm going, what the? Ooh, that might be a step too far.
I don't remember that being that way in the. I remember in the theater, wasn't it? It started with shots, didn't it?
There was nothing visual, if I remember correctly.
But in the theater, didn't it start with like a dark theater and gunshots to represent the assassination, or something like that?
It definitely
started with a suggestion of the assassination has just occurred.
Yeah, didn't it start with Cranston asleep on stage?
Okay.
Muttering in his sleep about something.
Okay.
Which we then get like a bit of voiceover really near the beginning of the movie. that I thought was the same thing as that. But I don't remember exactly what we see with it.
But I did not like them starting with the bloody car. That, for a lot of reasons. One, ew. But also because I felt like that's so out of character for what the rest of the movie is like and about. That felt like a really weird place to really, like, you know, I mean, it's don't judge a book by its cover. Don't necessarily judge a film by its opening scene, but, you know, this is how you're introducing yourself to the audience, and this is how you're doing it.
Yes, but that's because, you know, that's the day that America officially lost its innocence.
Are you making a connection to Virgin Blood here?
No, I'm just, because it's such a trope about movies set in 1963 about, that.
Now, one thing that I did like
actually
was...
can I make a point about JFK and the thrust of this? I find it very interesting that this play is called All the Way, because that was not originally an LBJ slogan. That was originally a JFK slogan, which he used as a carry-through. It started out as All the Way with JFK, and then he used it as All the Way with LBJ. It's kind of a continuation, and that kind of ties into how the whole Civil Rights Act was originally under Kennedy, which then continued through the finishing up the term that LBJ did.
Another thing that was different between play and film, I think, I don't remember it being in the play, was the whole scene with the amphibious car.
Yeah, because the play was all interiors, if I remember.
Well, I mean, it's a play, right? I mean, obviously they had lots of sets on this that they didn't have in the play. But I really liked that. I mean, because, you know, it's kind of like when you go see a 3D movie and it's clear they've done some things. It's like, let's throw this at the people in the audience just because we can 3D, right? And then, but then sometimes, you know, I am not a total 3D hater, unlike some people on the podcast. but so there are sometimes when I go to see a 3D movie and I'll think, wow, okay, if you're going to do 3D, this is why you do it. And I felt like something similar with that scene of, you know, you could have just put in the amphibious car scene because you could, you know, it's not in the theater, so this is something you have the ability to stage and do for the film. But I really thought it was a great addition to the film because it just did such a great job of characterizing LBJ.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of impishness that was there in him and how he was, how he related to people in that sort of keeping them on their toes kind of way. They never know what's going to happen next. I thought it wasn't just there because they could. They found a way to put that scene in a way that added something to the film other than just we couldn't do it in the stage.
Which ties into a couple other things that I thought were really well done in terms of him being impish but also intimidating. The moment when he is, I forget which senator he's dealing with in a elevator in Congress.
Oh, yeah.
And he is standing just a little too close. And LBJ was, I think, 6'4", 6'5", something like that. He was a tall, imposing man. And then there's the other part where he's basically insisting that he has to talk to one of his aides while he's on the crapper. Like, no, let's not do that. That's just weird.
Well, I mean, you could do that, but you at least close the door mostly and just talk through the door.
He was doing a power trip.
The other thing about that, I mean, because there's more scatological humor in a movie about and play about a president than you might expect. And I sent you guys a link to the short film that somebody did that was an animation of a phone conversation that LBJ had with his tailor. Or not his tailor. He called up the Hagar. The Hagar company that makes pants.
Yep.
And, you know, is giving them very specific measurements. And essentially that conversation makes it into the movie as not a phone conversation, but as a meeting with a tailor in the Oval Office. And I had the odd experience when I was in the theater, because that tape had been made public and that short film had gone, you know, a little bit viral several years before the play came out. Mm-hmm. And you could just tell in the theater, like when people realize there's a Taylor on the stage, I could just tell that people, and it's that weird feeling of like, oh, we know what joke is coming up kind of feeling. And so in a way, I almost disliked that they put it in into the play, at least, because I was like, this is just pandering. Because I'm that kind of snob. we'll put a link to it on the webpage. It's a fun conversation, and the little short film is quite clever and fun. But it was another way of characterizing, you know, the sort of plain spokenness of Johnson.
And I have one more closing thought before we move on.
Wait, I'm not done.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It could be your closing.
All right,
thought.
Keep. I'm sorry. You had more.
No, you can have your thought. It's just not the closing.
Oh, okay. It wasn't until the credits till I realized that was Melissa Leo playing Lady Bird.
Which I will give credit there. I think that was a very worthy performance for her. I mean, it's a small role, but I was impressed that I actually believed her as, like, it didn't occur to me that it was Melissa Leo. Because I feel like a lot of her roles of recent years, including the one for which she won the Oscar, have been Melissa Leo acting. You know? let's watch Melissa Leo act! And I thought this one was actually Melissa Leo acting, which was quite refreshing to see, to be reminded that she can do it.
Yeah.
Couple other thoughts I have was there was one quote that came out of it that I just thought, you know, because we're watching this in, you know, an election year, which is partially why you chose the topic, Randy.
Yeah.
The theme, Randy. But so someone says, you win a campaign by not losing it. And I just thought, oh, somebody needs to have that tattooed somewhere. The other thing that I wanted to bring up was, and I sent you guys this as well. So there's a pivotal speech late in the play and the film that takes place in New Orleans. And he's addressing a room full of people who are very hostile, and you know, it's in the context of him trying to get the civil rights bill passed, and you know, we've had the attacks in Mississippi on the people trying to get blacks registered to vote. We've had Cheney and the other two guys killed in that. You know, all that's kind of happened, and then you've had the Mississippi, basically blacks trying to get seated as delegates from Mississippi at the Democratic National Convention. And all this is going on, and, you know, there's all this talk about losing the South and in the upcoming election, you know, by losing it, meaning not voting Democrat. And it's this very long speech, and we can put up a link to this as well, because I looked it up. And there is a transcript of it, and I'm just going to explain why I'm bringing this up, is because first of all, the actual speech runs about 45 minutes long, if you listen to it, because they have a transcript and they have a recording of it. So obviously it's been truncated, you know, and paraphrased to some extent for the film itself. But there's a big part that gets featured where he says, he's talking about somebody having talked to a senator or whatever. He was talking about the economy and what a great future we could have in the South if we could just meet our economic problems, if we could just take a look at the resources of the South and develop them. And he said, Sammy, I wish I felt a little better. I would like to go back to old, and I won't call the name of the state. It wasn't Louisiana, and it wasn't Texas. I would like to go back down there and make them one more Democratic speech. I just feel like I have one in me. The poor old state, they haven't heard a Democratic speech in 80 years. All they, sorry, 30 years. In 30 years, all they ever hear at election time is Negro, Negro, Negro. Except Brian Cranston does not say Negro. He says the full-on N-word. And that just really surprised me, listening to it in the film, because I thought, I cannot imagine a sitting U.S. president using that word in a public forum, even if it's, you know, in the context of criticizing other people saying it. I'm like, I just cannot imagine that. So that's why I went looking for this transcript. First I went to look to see, was there an actual speech, or was this the occasion of the speech made up entirely? But no, it was a real speech. And then I just stumbled on this transcript. And I thought, okay, well, maybe for the purposes of the transcript, they've cleaned it up and, you know, typed Negro, Negro, Negro. And so I actually went and listened to the audio recording. And what's interesting to me, again, is that throughout the film, especially in conversational speech, Johnson will often say Negra, you know, which is a not uncommon pronunciation of the word from Southerners during that time period. But when you listen to the audio transcript, to the audio, he clearly says not Negra, but Negro. Very clearly says Negro. So there's no misinterpreting it. So my question to you is, why did they change it to the inflammatory word that wasn't what actually was said? And did it bother you, and why? Or did you just not even notice it? You're just like,
it didn't really register with me. I mean, obviously the word did, but just thinking about it at that level that you did not.
I didn't really know. I mean, I just kind of assumed that that was, you know, what he had said. Now it bothers me.
Well, it bothers me because, like I said, what just really made my ears prick up was, I cannot imagine any sitting president saying that word out loud in a public room with citizens and reporters, and in this case, it being recorded. I just can't imagine that. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of them that have said it behind closed doors in private conversation. I don't flatter myself that we've had such exalted men in the White House that they've avoided the word entirely. But to just in the context of the time, and I can't imagine Martin Luther King wanting to continue. I just can't imagine the black leadership wanting to work with him after that. And I can't imagine, you know, so that's what made me go, what? Did he actually say that? And now I'm mad at the filmmakers because I feel like they decided that they needed to push it to that because modern viewers needed that extra jolt or something.
Yeah.
You know, like they're recontextualizing it for a modern audience in a way that undermines what was historically accurate.
Yeah, I think that's a little over the top in trying to get some dramatic input.
You know, I guess there's also just a big part of me that is very attuned to, when a white person says the N-word.
It's like dropping a bomb in the middle of the room.
Well, and it's like, but it's worth examining,
yeah.
You know, and it's worth thinking about, wait a minute, did the actual person, Lyndon Baines Johnson, say that or not? Because that does make a difference.
Right.
So that would be my final point on it, is that that was a change, that was a decision either on the part of the actor, the screenwriter, the playwright, or a director. I don't know who gets the credit for it or the blame for it, but I think it's it is problematic.
Yeah.
Do you remember how it played in the play? Because I don't.
I don't. And honestly, because it takes place near the end. So by that point in the theater, my brain was probably full.
Yeah, because it's also worth pointing out that the movie is about, what, half an hour to 40 minutes shorter than the play?
Right.
Like, the play was close to 3 hours with intermission, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, and they obviously weren't going to do a film that was quite that long.
No, no.
But, you know, I kind of wish, in some ways, because my criticism of the play was that they should have cut out some of the MLK stuff and the black leadership stuff, but they left in the Cheney funeral, which is, you know, completely out of the story. It's kind of like, again, I'll tie it back into the book, where you're saying, Randy, you know, your criticism is, okay, this guy rode by on a horse, let's put him in. And it's like, you know, you can't tell the civil rights story without including Martin Luther King, but you need to make a decision from a person who is structuring a narrative how much of that needs to be included. And
right.
I honestly, in one way, wish that what HBO had done was, you've got a 3-hour play, make this a 2 or 3 part miniseries and bring in maybe some more of those scenes and make it, give it a richer context about that whole year, instead of just kind of putting in here and making the leap here and, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because it felt to me like if there was about half an hour or so less material in the movie than in the play, that most of what would have been cut was Martin Luther King related. Like, there, he was a bigger presence in the movie, or in the play, than in the movie, if I remember correctly.
He was. So they did cut some of those scenes.
Yeah.
That what they seemed to me to cut out was, like, I think we only really had like maybe one scene of the black leadership arguing with one another.
Yeah.
And I feel like there were more of those in the play.
Mm-hmm.
Of those guys sitting around and arguing, do we trust LBJ? What do we want to do? That
yeah.
kind of thing.
And the other fascinating thing, just in terms of timing, was this was on Broadway in the spring of 2014. At the end of 2014, the movie Selma came out, which was, on one level, I mean, it was about a lot of things, but on one level, it was about the Martin Luther King LBJ relationship from a completely different perspective. Okay. So it was fascinating to see the play and that movie in the same year, and then to see this adaptation 2 years later.
Right.
And I have one thing I'd like to bring up, just on a completely lighter note. It amuses me that this is directed by Jay Roach, who started out with like the Austin Powers and the Fockers movies, but in like the last 6 or 7 years has made this weird left turn into things like Game Change and Recount and what was it, Will Ferrell, Zach Galifianakis movie? Campaigners? The Campaign? Something like that.
Oh, The Campaign. Yeah.
And it's like, that's just a weird shift in his career there. I don't know,
I guess we can probably thank Danny Strong for that.
Yes, and you know what? Thank you, Danny Strong. I wouldn't have expected you would turn into an interesting TV movie writer. You know, good on you. And some movie writing too. I think he did like the last couple of Hunger Games.
Hunger Games, yeah.
Yeah. And actually, Randy, I think you might have seen it, so I'm kind of curious about your take on Jay Roach directing Cranston in this, because he also directed Trumbo.
He did, didn't he?
Yeah.
I hated Trumbo.
that was my remembrance of it. I wasn't sure if I was right, because I know a lot of people really didn't like Trumbo.
And at this point, I couldn't tell you why.
I just felt like Trumbo was going to be one of those Hollywood masturbates itself movies.
Yeah. And I only saw it after it got the Oscar nominations because I wasn't interested at all. But being a completist for the Oscar nominations, I felt I had to see it. I don't really have anything to say on Trumbo other than I saw it. I didn't like it. That's it.
And finally, my final thought about Jay Roach. He's married to Susanna Hoffs? What the hell?
Huh.
I mean, good on him.
Yeah. That is my... Okay, we're going to get way off field here. My single favorite thing that Dennis Miller has ever, ever, ever contributed to pop culture was his impression of Susanna Hoffs, which just involved him being entirely still except moving his eyes back and forth.
Nice. Well, let's get into the theme for next time. I had the theme this time with the help of Amy, who suggested a much better title for it. And I wanted you guys to give me things that were loopy, but I love it. Things that are nuts, but you just can't help but like it because it's just really well done, even though it's completely insane. Maybe not even make that much sense. Amy.
And do you want to explain what prompted you to come up with this theme?
No. Amy, you had the movie.
Oh, I have to do it. Okay. Yes. So somehow, I don't know, who brought it up,
me.
Randy?
I did.
You brought it up.
Yeah.
So you, how did you bring it up?
There was, I can't remember what website it was, they had posted a list of like the top 15 action movies of this, since like 2000, and I just posted, I tweeted a link to it and said, this list needs more of a certain title. And then you mentioned how much you loved it, and Joe mentioned he'd never seen it. And that led it to this.
Yeah, because apparently Randy and I... Randy and I have... we don't have identical taste. Is that... That's fair to say.
Sure.
That's fair to say.
Yeah.
The overlap is a lot.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of things about which we do not agree. However, apparently we both agree that Shoot 'Em Up... from 2007, starring Clive Owen, Monica Bellucci, and Paul Giamatti, is a corker of an action film.
It's so fucking awesome.
And I saw it in the theater. It was like me and three other people on opening weekend. So that tells you how well this movie did. And the reason I went to see it is because somebody said, it's basically if Clive Owen was Bugs Bunny with a gun and an R rating.
Yeah, and I think that's
and
all
I
we
said,
need to say.
I will see that.
Yeah.
And I did, and it was crazy over the top, and I enjoyed it. And it even had something in it that offended me, and yet I still enjoyed it. So that speaks to my overall liking of the film.
The director has directed nothing since then.
Well, no, it tanked him. I mean, we're lucky they didn't take Clive Owen out back and shoot him. I mean, Giamatti, sure. I mean, we keep him around because, you know, we like our schlubs, but, you know, anyway. So here's the basic plot description. After saving a newborn infant from assassins, carrot crunching, see, gunman Mr. Smith teams up with a prostitute named DQ, which you may think disqualification. I think Dairy Queen,
Yeah. Which
makes sense when you see the movie, to protect the baby from further attacks. With hitman Hertz, Paul Giamatti, hot on their trail, Smith and DQ uncover a dying senator's plot to harvest bone marrow from babies just like the one in their arms. There you go. So it's got a little bit of, what was it? Was it hard-boiled? Where
the Woo film?
Is that the hospital?
Yeah, remember? The guy that was in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
Chow
Yun-fat climbs down the side of a hospital with a baby.
Yeah, that's hard-boiled.
Yeah, so it's got a little bit of hard-boiled. Carrot chomping, you got a little bit of Bugs Bunny. We'll just talk about why me thinking DQ means Dairy Queen means something interesting when you see this film.
Okay.
When you see this film. And Paul Giamatti playing a hitman. So yeah, it's crazy. I enjoyed it. I have not seen it since 2007. So I hope, you know, since I'm all woke and shit now, let's hope I don't hate it. Let's hope I haven't become too politically correct to enjoy this movie.
We can cut this part all out, by the way, but I'd like to note that movie coming out next year, Clive Owen is in a Luc Besson movie next year. Valerian.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Get this cast, people. I don't know who Dane DeHaan is, so we'll just.
Oh, he was in. He was in Chronicle.
He's got some cheekbones.
Oh, him. Yeah. Okay, fine.
I'm sorry. He may have a name, but in my head, he is Mr. Cheekbones.
Cara Delevingne.
She's got eyebrows.
Who's getting just reviews that almost sound unfair for Suicide Squad. Clive Owen. Rihanna. Ethan Hawke. I haven't gotten up to the good people yet. John Goodman. Herbie Hancock. Yes, the musician. And finally, Rutger Hauer.
Wow.
I am on board already. Because, fuck y'all, Luc Besson, when he does completely whacked out shit, right up my alley.
Well, he did Lucy, right?
Yes, he did.
He directed Lucy.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
This is apparently based on a science fiction comic series from France, Valerian and Laureline. I know nothing about it, but I'm on board. Except for the part where Cara Delevingne is one of the leads. Oh, God. Why?
Why? But I'm also assuming that Suicide Squad is not her fault.
Fair.
So, here is an article I just found called Why Shoot 'Em Up is One of the Most Misunderstood Action Movies Ever Made.
Because nobody saw it, so they couldn't understand it.
So, I will have to... This is not the silly action movie that most take it as. That's me. Just the three lead actors in the film alone should tell you that. Clive Owen, blah, blah, blah. Trust me, this is not that action movie. This is the movie that is completely mocking those movies and doing so with Shakespearean levels of brilliance.
Okay.
So, anyway, well, I'll have to read and see if I agree with them.
I might not agree with the word mocking because it is a straight-up action movie. But I'll have to read that article as well.
Wow, Clive Owen had an Oscar nomination for Closer? I'd completely forgotten that movie even existed.
Closer.
Closer.
Closer. Closer, closer.
It's not like a Glengarry Glenn Ross thing.
It should have been.
Or a, what's her name, Kira Sedgwick thing.
Oh, yeah. He should have had a nomination for Croupier, but that is neither here nor there.
Children of Men.
That too.
Yeah, I can't even think about
wait a
that
second.
Movie.
Which one was Kara Sedgwick? Was she a psychic of some kind in The Closer?
No.
Because there were a whole bunch around the same time. There was like The Closer. There was the
TV show The Closer.
Right.
There was, where she plays a detective.
There was The Closer. There
She's
was the
comes in and closes the case.
Yeah.
She's The Closer.
There was the guy who was a experiment of some kind, and he could impersonate anybody.
I don't know what the fuck that is.
They're all around about the same time. Talk amongst yourselves for 2 seconds.
I mean, I watched The Closer for the first few seasons just because Kira Sedgwick's southern accent was amazing.
Thank you.
I don't mean that it was good. I mean it was amazing. Also because I really liked the guy, what's his name, Michael Chan?
I don't
remember.
You know,
he played Lieutenant Chan. Oh, I can't remember what Chan was the actor's name or the character's name.
I only remember Corey Reynolds.
Oh, that's not a... Oh, that's a nice thing to remember.
Yeah.
The Pretender. That's what I was thinking of.
Oh, The Pretender.
Starring Michael T. Weiss. Okay. Yes. I can picture him, but I have no idea what the hell he's up to these days. He's actually a guy that I don't mind when he pops up in things. I kind of like him.
You may remember him from Days of Our Lives.
Not really.
Or the movie adaptation of Jeffrey. Did you see Jeffrey, Amy?
Wait. Was that the one with the chubby black guy?
I don't think so. It was the Patrick Stewart and it's Jeffrey's a gay movie.
I know it's a gay movie, but which gay movie? It's not the one with Jason Alexander in a tutu.
No, that was
Valor Compassion.
Yeah, this is the one with Steven Weber.
Not the one with the softball team and Frasier's dad.
No, that's Broken Hearts Club.
It's not the one with the Mormon.
Angels in America?
No, I found one that you don't know. What was that one called? The one with the Mormon. Latter Day.
Speaking of which, what's his name? Who was the lead in Book of Mormon? Was on another period this past 2 weeks, and he's hysterical.
Andrew Reynolds?
Yes, thank you. I couldn't think of his name last night. He's a funny man with good material.
Okay, I'm going to refocus this. So I picked Shoot 'Em Up as my loopy but I love it movie. Mm-hmm. Randy, what are you making this read?
I went in a slightly different direction.
That would not be difficult to do.
And I think this will provide for some interesting point-counterpoint discussion. Because the theme that Joe had initially proposed was sort of awesome people doing awesome things, and then it kind of morphed into loopy
because
but I love it.
Called people awesome.
True. I kind of thought, okay, well, I kind of zeroed in on the concept of child geniuses, and so I was looking for a book about.
I want to know how that leap happened, but okay.
So I was like, okay, well, let's just do some child geniuses. And then, so the book we will be reading is Roald Dahl's Matilda from 1988, I believe. Now, I was convinced that I read, because I believe I read all of Dahl's stuff when I was a kid, but since Matilda came out when I would have been 14 or 15, that suggests it was after my Dahl phase, so I'm not sure if I don't think I've actually read this, although I think I have. Although I should say, I don't think I've read it, although I thought I did, is what I'm trying to say there. And it's short answer, just the, because it was adapted into a movie in 1996, the one sentence description, the story of a wonderful little girl who happens to be a genius and her wonderful teacher versus the worst parents ever and the worst school principal imaginable. So it's sort of, it'll definitely be loopy in that Dahl sort of way, and should be better than the BFG because that was just a slog to get through. And I'm looking forward to reading it, and I think it should be fun to discuss two completely different things, like Shoot 'Em Up and Matilda.
Fantastic.
One is very R-rated, and the other one is not.
Yes.
Although I'm pretty sure they're both going to say equally disturbing things about the human nature.
And honestly, I think for extra credit, watch the Matilda movie from, it's 20 years old this year. It's from 96, which I think is a charming adaptation. And it's a good, DeVito directed it. It's a good directing job.
Yes.
So, in 2 weeks, we will be watching Shoot 'Em Up from 2007, you said?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, and we'll be reading Matilda from 19...
Don't get it confused with all those other shoot 'em ups.
Well, every action movie is a shoot 'em up. Ah! Anyway, that was terrible. So, we'll be watching that. We'll be reading Matilda, and you can find us online at tryandlikeit.blogspot.com. You can find me on the Twitters at Joseph Finn, JOSEPHFINN. You can find Amy at Amy Watts, AMYWATTS. And you can find Randy at Randois, RANDOIS. Okay, so we'll be back in 2 weeks, folks, and thanks for listening.